I look at art from the creative aspect of the art and how powerful it is in the service of the interests of the people. You apply the things that you can use from the system, but you use it in a positive way to serve the interests of the community.
The images were called shocking, even dangerous. They showed the people that those in power didn't want to see. They were the message for a newspaper that was one of the most read publications in the world. And the images, words, and art were so powerful, so threatening to the status quo, that the U.S. government was actively working to destroy them.
We were creating a culture. A culture of resistance, a culture of defiance and self-determination.
How did illustrations embolden a community? How did caricatures, portraits, and parody empower a movement and terrify the FBI? And what can we learn from the art of Emory Douglas and the Black Panther newspaper about how to make art as resistance today and tomorrow? From Rebel Yell Creative, this is The Art of Resistance, a podcast about channeling our rage into creation and using writing, music, and all kinds of art to resist the status quo. I'm your host and producer, Amy Lee Lillard, and I'm an author, podcaster, an autistic person who's been obsessing over artists who resisted since I was a kid. And today, I'm looking to make all the weird art and help others do the same. Emory Douglas was raised in San Francisco in the 1950s. It was a time and place that tried to teach him his place. This is Emory from a 2008 interview in his studio.
Growing up as a youngster, you know, I used to live over in the Western District, which is Fillmore. It used to be Fillmore. There were incidents now as a youngster that you knew that weren't right, and you things that you seen that you knew weren't right. It was reinforced in the Black community. You had to wear a dog tag with your name on it in San Francisco. And your age, if you were caught out after a certain hour, they would arrest you. You had a curfew back then.
After his arrest, the juvenile detention facility had him work in a print shop. After release, he went to City College and learned more about the printing process. Meanwhile, in the 1950s and early 60s, he watched footage of the civil rights protests down south, where police unleashed fire hoses and dogs on peaceful demonstrators. It was powerful, but also disheartening. That's what white people were willing to do to stop Black people from having basic self-determination. Then in 1966, Emory learned about a new organization.
One of the brothers just mentioned that there was a group of brothers who were organizing in Oakland who were doing self-defense. He didn't even know their name. Hearing about that, then going to the meeting, and they expressed what they were going to do, and I seen them there coming, they were armed and the whole bit, and they looked disciplined. That's what I wanted to be a part of. So it was thereafter that I asked them about joining.
The Black Panthers were not interested in the nonviolence preached by Martin Luther King Jr. and others from the civil rights movement. The movement had done little to help Black people outside the South, and barely there. This kind of action couldn't truly liberate Black people, or even give them power over their own lives. Instead, the Black Panthers were created on the principle of self-defense. Specifically, they said Black people should take up arms to defend themselves against the police by any means necessary. The founders, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, were in a studio apartment one day in 1967, putting together a newspaper to describe their mission when Emory Douglas stopped by. He told them he had access to printing materials from City College and could help out. He made some drawings. Huey and Bobby liked what they saw.
It said because the black community wasn't a reading community, but they learned through observation and participation, we want to have a lot of images so that those who weren't going to read along our articles would get the gist of what was going on by looking at the photographs and the captions under the photographs. So they had this whole vision. And they say you would be the revolutionary artist and eventually you become the minister of culture.
Just a year later, as chapters were popping up all over the country, the party message shifted. Instead of armed vigilance, the Black Panthers would now focus on social justice, education, and community empowerment. That meant programs to help low-income communities, like free breakfasts for all school kids, 20,000 children every day. They gave away free clothes and shoes to those kids that needed them. They sponsored schools, legal aid offices, local ambulance service, and health clinics and sickle cell testing centers in several cities. They organized voter registration drives and campaigned for prison reform. Eventually, they even ran for office. This evolved focus also meant education about the systems of oppression that crossed color lines.
Black Panther Party enlightened me and informed me, transformed my thinking idea. Because when you are isolated in a community and all you see is white oppression, then the symbolism of oppression becomes white. You see what I'm saying? When you articulate, you may attribute say white folks, but you're really talking about the system. Black Panther Party was never a racist organization. So you have to overcome those obstacles through education. And that was what the Black Panther Party brought to the table.
This is Chicago Black Panther Party leader Fred Hampton from a 1969 event.
We're not a racist organization because we understand that racism is an excuse used for capitalism. And we know that racism is just it's a byproduct of capitalism. We'll work with anybody and form coalition with anybody that has revolution on their mind.
They meant what they said. Over the years, they built alliances and worked closely with other organizations dedicated to fighting oppression. Latinx, Asian, Indigenous, and international anti-colonial revolutionary movements. In just one example, when the disabled community took over a government building in 1977 to demand equal access to schooling and employment, the officials locked the doors and tried to starve the demonstrators out. One quick phone call from the organizer, Judith Heumann, and the Black Panthers showed up every day with free security and free food for everyone. From his starting point in 1967 for about 12 years, Emery designed all of the weekly issues of the Black Panther newspaper. 537 issues in all. He used everything he'd learned about print production, used simple tools like markers, rub-off type, and prefabricated texture materials. To keep costs low, each paper was printed in one or two colors. They worked in people's bedrooms, and work was done quick and on the cheap. The resulting images are beautiful and awful, and enraging, and empowering. In his book, Black Panther, which is a fantastic collection of his covers and other art, Emery says he wanted to show the conditions that made revolution reasonable, even necessary. That meant showing people fighting back against slumlords, and people declaring their rights, and yes, even taking up arms. That meant showing the things affecting everyone. Capitalism run amok, imperialism, fighting wars started by greedy leaders, lack of health care, poor education. At the same time, Emery also wanted to show pride and hope in being Black. He made covers and posters that talk about thriving while fighting, about bright futures, education, happy people fighting for their happiness. He frequently made covers and posters that showed one catch-all image for the oppressors, the pig.
Huey wanted me to draw this pig, stand it up on two hoofs, put the belt around it, and that became a symbol of those who were abusing their power.
Pig was gonna put the badge number of the policeman who was harassing people in the community every week. The community was so excited about the pig caricature initially that you knew that people were inspired by that, and through that they could vent their laughter about the situation or what have you. So it was a psychological impact that it had.
And the art, it went there. The pig was first one particular officer. Then it became a representation for all those in power. Covers and art showed President Lyndon Johnson's cabinet as pigs that were lynched. The covers said, "All power to the people, death to the pigs." It said, "For every pork chop, there is a frying pan." Here's Emery from a 2021 interview.
It's a visual language, and it's just a way to communicate the art itself. It's for whom it serves. It's just a reflection of the politics. We want to tell our story from our perspective. So the art was a reflection of that in the context of service, in service of the community. You know, and hearing those issues and concerns and the pain, the suffering, and all that, and you interpret that in your artwork.
Emery followed the party credo of each one, teach one. He mentored and managed party members in producing the paper, and mentored and inspired artists to make art that also appeared in the paper.
Each one teach one. That's what was our thing. That was always all through the party. You always had cadre of folks who worked with you, may have had art skills but didn't understand how to put the political content into the art. So that was became my responsibility, and to coordinate the people who I worked with.
Emery made the newspaper covers and art inside the pages. He also made a full back cover for every issue, which was often reprinted separately in full color. These were pasted on buildings, walls, windows, telephones, all over the community. It was art to see yourself in, to see the common struggle in. And oftentimes, it was a reminder of why the fight was necessary. The leaders and many members of the Black Panthers were arrested again and again on trumped up or entirely false charges. Huey Newton, Angela Davis, the New York 21, and Bobby Seale, who had the distinction of being the first to be bound and gagged for demanding self-representation in court. But it wasn't just local police driving these arrests. In 1972, a group of activists stole all the files from a local Pennsylvania FBI office and sent them to the media. The files showed a decades-long campaign by the FBI to harass, frame, arrest, and take out internal threats to the country. J. Edgar Hoover and many of his agents had all been members of fraternities with ties to the Ku Klux Klan. So in their eyes, any and all Black activists were dangerous, threats to the country. This campaign by the FBI was named COINTELPRO, and it was highly illegal. They tapped phones without warrants. They conducted random searches without cause. They blackmailed with abandon. And they planted agents and assets into the target organizations. And because at the time the FBI was seen by many in America as faultless, their portrayal of the Black Panthers is the reason that there's an image of the Black Panther Party as violent terrorists, an image that survives to this day. The Black Panthers knew the FBI was surveilling them, as did many other organizations that were on the FBI target list. But there was no recourse. when the cops with the most power were defying laws every damn day, who can stop it? This is Emery from 2023.
When the police attacked our office around, I think this was late 1967, going to 68, the verdict came in when Huey Newton had been charged with the murder of the Oakland police, and that he was exonerated from that. And we felt that the police would come by and do something crazy. So we left the office early that day. Sure enough, they came by and they shot up the office.
And that amount of power kept growing. In Chicago, the local police were given free rein. They murdered Black Panther leader Fred Hampton with the help of an FBI informant. The stolen FBI files eventually led to a reckoning for the FBI, but it was temporary. Every administration since Reagan has given the FBI and other agencies more power to spy, harass, and take out opposition, even within the country. And this all showed up in the pages of the Black Panther newspaper. Emery drew covers and posters reminding people that Black Panther leaders were in prison illegally. He drew art to tell the story of Fred Hampton. And maybe most important of all, he showed people that they were right. The powers that be were doing everything they could to keep that power. So how do you measure the impact of the Black Panther newspaper and Emery's art? Especially in the face of massive, organized, and illegal backlash. The Black Panther newspaper had some impressive numbers. Over its run from about 1967 to about 1980, at its peak, it was read by 400,000 people and had the highest readership of any paper in the U.S. There's also other data. The newspaper was distributed around the world, and activists from every kind of community shared Emery's art to project a spirit of shared struggle. Maybe the most impactful thing we can take as creators is the Black Panthers conceived of revolutionary artists as a key role and critical part of the revolution. They saw the power of art and knew how art, politics, and life are all inseparable. Huey, Bobby, Emery, and all the Black Panthers knew art could power structural, lasting change. Simply by showing the community, encouraging pride, and telling everyone to seize their time here, to take the power back for themselves. And in the process, they inspired generations.
People, and they began to see themselves and their family and aunties and cousins, they used to say that they would see them in that artwork and stuff. You have to deal with middle class folks. You see, and that's what the party was able to do. We dealt with everybody, man. We dealt with mainstream folks. We worked with unions. We had people who came into unions who worked with us. We had people who worked with the handicapped folks. We had people who worked on the campus and students. Then the churches. We were changing the young ideas of brown people, yellow people, white people, young people across this country. It was picking up and inspired and pushing forward their own programs in the same spirit of the Panthers.
What can we learn from Emery Douglas? What can we do as creative people in this world that doesn't seem so far from the world of the Black Panthers? Because we are all creative, we can all find ways to resist. I want to leave us with this quote from Emery in his position paper number 1 on revolutionary art, published in 1970. Revolutionary art is an art that flows from the people. It must be a whole and living part of the people's lives, their daily struggle to survive. The revolutionary artist's talents are just one of the weapons he uses in the struggle. His art becomes a tool for liberation. The ghetto itself is the gallery for the revolutionary artist's drawings. His work is pasted on the walls of the ghetto, in storefront windows, fences, doorways, alleyways, gas stations, laundromats. This way, the revolutionary artist educates the people as they go through their daily routine, from day to day, week to week, and month to month. This way, the revolutionary artist cuts through the smoke screens of the oppressor and creates brand new images of revolutionary action for the total community. Art is resistance. It's a weapon, a tool, an entire course of learning. But more than anything, it's truth that can cut through the bullshit. Art doesn't have to be fancy. Doesn't have to be product-driven, and it doesn't have to be determined by gatekeepers. So here's what we do from here. We tell our stories in our way. We get creative and get weird and work beyond the parameters we think box us in. We create revolutionary art to reach the people who need to see it and hear it. And we don't think of this as short-term. Even if we get a new administration down the road, even if we miraculously come out of this terrifying, tyrannical moment, there's so much to fight against and for. This is a long-term commitment to making art for a better world. The Art of Resistance is a podcast for the artists, the lovers of art, and people who want to resist but don't know how. These stories are designed to help us find inspiration from the past and empower us all to find some hope for today and tomorrow. I'm Amy Lee Lillard, and I wrote, narrated, and produced this show. And there's so much more to this story. At RebelYellCreative.com, you'll find sources, images, and videos for this episode and all the others. Plus, at RebelYellCreative.com, there's a full resistance library with posters and art to download, places to explore online, and journals and kits to get in the mail. Here's an easy way to get more art as resistance. Sign up for the free newsletter at RebelYellCreative.com and get stories and tips every week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.